Song of Solomon, we'll begin in chapter 3 and verse 6 through chapter 4. If you're new to Denton Bible, the Song of Solomon is about marital love and marital intimacy, about how to be romantic with your mate. God gives us a whole book in the Song of Solomon. Let me begin this text by giving you a little fable. Once upon a time, there was a man who went down to a river to live with the people of a river that lived up and down a riverbed. And he sat down to eat with these people down by the river, and he ate with them, had a good time. Then he noticed that out of the corner of his eye, he saw something moving out of the river, and here came a 1,700-pound crocodile up out of the river. And that crocodile was coming up towards the table where they were eating, and nobody seemed to notice. They noticed they wouldn't do anything, and he cried out, "There's a crocodile right here." But the woman shushed him and said, "We don't talk about crocodiles. It's impolite." And the crocodile reached out and just took a leg right off one of those kids. Took his leg. The guy screamed, "Good night." Mama ran up, grabbed the kid, and cried. She said, "We don't talk about crocodile." Crocodile grabbed another kid and took his screaming body, pulled him back into the river, and he disappeared in a pool of blood. And the man was just going into shock. And he just walked up and down the river and heard crying all up and down the river and all these people weeping. And he began to notice there were a lot of kids running around missing a leg, gashes and wounds on him. Crocodiles seemed to enjoy most of all teenagers. They chomped teenagers, and teenagers disappeared. Just all kind of teenagers weeping and crying, big unhealed wounds all over them. A lot of times he'd grab a man or a woman, he'd break up a family. Crocodiles, but nobody ever talked about crocodiles. You had crocodile magazines. You could go into a truck stop and look on the bathroom walls. You see crocodile limericks. Preachers stand up in the pulpits and talk about how bad them crocodiles were, how we need to get rid of them, but they never taught them because you didn't talk about crocodiles because it was rude. Never talked about where they came from, how they worked, what they ate, what their habits were. You didn't want to understand crocodiles. You just were afraid of them. Man just continued, watched in that society, and the people continued to cry, and the children were maimed, and the teenagers were destroyed, and families were into upheaval. But you never mentioned crocodiles. Sex. This is church time. Okay. Try it at home. "Dad, tell me about sex." Shut up. You don't talk about sex. We're at the table. Don't talk about that. Go ask your mother. Like the rest of us. We don't talk about it in the home. We don't talk about sex. Well, let's try it in school. Tell me about sex. But we're not supposed to talk about sex in schools because we got the deal that, you know, we only treat it in an academic or a physical way. You know, in school, you can only treat it clinically. You can't talk about God's role in it. You can only talk about the uterus. And remember those terms you memorized and forgot about ovums and blastulas and those tubes, those Ephesian tubes or Philippians. Fallopian tube. I knew I was in the New Testament. Just couldn't place it. So we don't talk about it. You can't talk about it in school, and you don't talk about it in church. You can't talk about it at home. So we tell the kid, go learn it the way I did on the playground, on the streets. And so he does. But you never really understand about it. And he looks at magazines on it and hears stand-up comedy on it. He knows it's there until he's about 14. She's about 14. Then a crocodile comes out of the river. And there's the most incredible, overpowering urge. The most destructive thing they have ever seen in their life is on them. Something that can cause greater pain, greater heartache, greater tears, long-lasting wounds, unhealed marks. And they get married, and they've never talked about it. And they go into marriage, and now you may have swept it under the rug in the home and in the church and never talked about it in the church, but all of a sudden you get married and now sex is not something you sweep under the rug. Now it is a glaring thing going off in neon lights, and if it is not practiced in a gentility with the way that God ordains it, you have couples that go through years of silent pain and heartache and disappointment and anger and bitterness and frustration, and it becomes quite often the bar of leverage that separates and divorces that of sex. And yet God has given us an entire chapter of a book of the Bible to tell you how to make love to your mate. Do you know that? How many of you in your entire life, unless you've been to Denton Bible, you may have heard it. How many of you have ever heard the Song of Solomon chapter 4 done in a verse-by-verse exposition? I've had two so far today. Has anybody here heard Song of Solomon chapter 4? That's two out of about 1,800 people. If you've been in church for an average of 10 years apiece, even 5 years apiece, That's about 8,000 years of church. 8,000 years. 50 sermons a pop. That's almost 500,000 sermons. And yet you've heard 2 or 3 messages on the Song of Solomon, chapter 4. Now maybe it isn't a big issue. Maybe sex is something you need to listen to every 10,000 years. Not in my life it isn't. I'll guarantee you. It's an important part of the intimacy that I have with my wife. How about you? I mean, well, this morning we're going to study Song of Solomon, chapter 4. And I want to make a couple of statements before we begin. If you are divorced, God love you, and I know this is painful. But it's got to be taught. Especially want to make a statement here. If you're single, how many singles we got? Good night. All right. There's 8 chapters in this book. 4 of them are written to singles. Take notes. If you're married and you got a great marriage, you take notes too. Because if you get effective in your marital ministry to others, you will teach this chapter. Anytime you have a marital problem, it's going to show up in the bedroom. Always. You will teach this chapter. And I tell you something else, and I'm going to say it once, and I could say it 50 times. There are a whole bunch of you out here who have disobeyed this teaching. There's a bunch of you that didn't come into marriage pure. Be of good cheer. Can God take a bad situation and redeem it? You bet. He's a carpenter, and He has always been a carpenter. And so don't let me see your eyes go down. Don't let me see your heart break. Don't let me see you wipe away tears. Because you can start over and make it right. You know that last Sunday, we have a college service here in the evening. The college service, the first week we started Song of Solomon, had 350 kids. Last week we had 500 kids here. We have 500 here. We pack this place with college students. We had them in the kitchen. We had them sitting on the table out there, on the tape table. You think they want to know about this? The word got out on the campus that they were talking about love, sex, and marriage. Because those kids are asking questions. So we're going to study about sex, about how God intended it. It's kind of tough if you have a marquee in your church. How do you advertise this thing, you know? Maximum sex. Song of Solomon. Let's take a look. I'm going to show you 7 different keys of how God intended for a married couple to enjoy marital intimacy. Okay? You begin with your first, and I want you to look at chapter 2 in verse 6 and 7. This couple is attracted to each other. And the wife in chapter 2 verse 6 says, "Let his left hand be under my head and his right hand embrace me." You remember our interpretation of that? She desired the most intimate of positions and the most intimate of acts. She wanted his arms around her, holding her close. She desired him. Because sexual affections are good. God put them there. But you have a guy in chapter 2, verse 7 that says, "Don't arouse or awaken love until it pleases." Not yet. Not yet. You've got to have a grating around that fireplace. And God rewarded their patience in verse 8 of chapter 2 with the deepest relationship they had had up till now. To where in chapter 3, in verse 5, this woman desires this man even stronger. And he says in verse 5, "Don't arouse or awaken love until it pleases." Twice this couple has waited. Each time God rewards a patient single with a blessed marriage. And look here what patience, because that's the first point about sex, is patience. You wait as this girl waited. She sowed to the Spirit, and now she's going to reap a great marriage. She has waited for the right guy, right time, right place, the right way. And God, in verse 6 through verse 11 of chapter 3, you see their wedding day, and this man comes for his wife. And in verse 6, there is perfume around him because he delights her. In verse 7, he has 60 groomsmen with swords. I've seen a wedding with 12 groomsmen, never 60. There are 60 groomsmen around this sedan that is carried by them to this woman, and they're armed. They're the mighty men of David. What would you do, ladies, if you walked forward at your wedding and there were 60 groomsmen up and down that wall and all of them had 357 Magnum? They are loaded and the hammer is cocked. You would say, "I am pretty protected by this guy." This guy protects her. He delights her. In verse 9 and 10, notice what his limousine looks like. You'll notice a lot of times after a wedding, the guy will always take his wife so often to the reception with a white limousine or a Rolls Royce. because he's letting her know you're so special. Well, Solomon has one in verse 9. It's made from the timber of Lebanon. Verse 10, it has posts of silver, a back of gold, a seat of purple, and the interior lovingly fitted out. He loves this woman. She's so special. He delights her. He protects her. And there in verse 11, he has on his crown, which his mother appointed him. He is King Solomon. He impresses her. You know, it was such a neat feeling to me, and I want to let you singles know it. My wife and I, by God's grace, did it right. And we waited on each other. She was a beautiful woman, and when I was a young stud, I was a handsome man back then. And boy, let me tell you, we felt the emotions, and there was a lot of times, man, I'd give her a goodnight kiss up there, and maybe give her another one, and I'd hear, dun-dun. You know, the Jaws theme coming around because, man, I know that there's some passion in me. We'd have to push away and wait and wait. But, man, what a neat day it was. August 23rd, 1973, when she came down that aisle and I saw this package God gave me that was mine for 60 years, Lord willing, to unwrap. It's neat to wait and to do it right. And this couple has waited and God has awarded them with something so great. First key about sex is patience. Because, singles, whenever you are impatient in sex, you're going to do one of two things. You're going to harm a good relationship, or you're going to prolong a bad one. When I say harm a good relationship, one of the worst things you can do is to get into premarital sex. And I tell you why. Because it teaches you to communicate on a surface way. And sex becomes the power of your marriage instead of the follow-through. Sex is not meant to be the power of your marriage. You can't run a marriage on sex. It's meant to be the follow-through. See, the reason God gives sex is because whenever I and my wife feel these feelings of tenderness, love, admiration, respect, devotion, appreciation, thankfulness, unless you're Shakespeare, Byron, Shelley, or Keats, you can't let it be known how you feel. Especially most of you good old boys. The biggest word you know is delicatessen. All right? And you can't reach down. I mean, how are you guys going to tell your wife about how deep? Well, you know, sugar, I'll shoot, man, I'll tell you. That's about the best you can do. But you know what? In sex, I can take all of my feelings and I can put them on the tips of my fingers. And God has given us a bark on our body of sensitivity and sexual stimulation to where I can take the deepest emotions and I can put them at a fingertips and I can make her feel so loved. It's like a hydraulic system on a jet. Here's this thing that's so big, so massive. You can't understand it, the inner workings, and yet in a jet, you've got a hydraulic system. You know how you fly a jet? With these two fingers. You just twitch it. That thing will take off. You bank it this way. It's so touchable. And that's what sex is. It's a hydraulic system. To where you've got these deep embers. And you follow through. I can love her. I can buy things for her. I can provide for her. But my final way is sex. And so it will, if you get into it too early, you never learn how to dig deep. And I'm also convinced there's a lot of couples who should have never been married. They couldn't communicate, they couldn't reconcile, they fought with each other, they didn't respect each other, and the campfire started dying out. So you know what they did? They took lighter fluid and they squirted it on it. And it went up. Passion always feels like love. Always. But when it dies out and that intimacy is not there, man, it becomes a barren, barren thing. So wait. Wait for God's best. Be patient. Look at the next thing. 4:1-7, he's going to compliment his wife. He starts with her eyes and he says, they are like doves behind your veil. He says, your hair is like a flock of goats. Now let me interpret that. Okay, some of you guys are going to get in the midst of passion. You're going to say, baby, hair on your shoulder is like an animal. And I don't mean that. What this means is, this is a shepherd, and you'd see the goats and the flock coming down from the mountains, and they come down in streams. He looks at the tresses of his wife coming down her shoulders. He says, your eyes are so beautiful and your hair is so soft. And incidentally, guys, that's a very provocative statement. Jewish women wore their hair up. She has let her hair down. They're at the Sheraton right now. Okay? And what's going to happen? You're not going to see this couple touch until about halfway through the chapter. This woman, it's going to look like she is undressing, and that's exactly what she is doing. And he's looking at her body, and he starts up here, and he goes right down her body. He says in verse 2, he looks at her smile, her teeth. Because what do you do on honeymoon? You grin, baby. All right. It's good. And so here she is. He says, your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes that have come up from their washing. She has clean teeth. There is nothing like a wife with funky breath. All right. Brush your teeth, women. And then he says, all of which bear twins. She has got straight teeth. And she says, not one has lost her young. She has got all her teeth in there. And so he looks at the smile of his wife. His wife is smiling at her. And he says, your smile is so pretty. And then he says in verse 3, your lips are like a scarlet thread. Your mouth is lovely. He looks at the sweet definition of her lips. He says, you're so pretty. He says, your temples are like a slice of pomegranate, talking about the redness of her cheeks. Your neck is like the Tower of David built upon rows of stones. The Tower of David stood toward Assyria. And that was when you saw it, it was the nation's national defense was the Tower of David. He looks at her neck and he sees nobility. Have you ever noticed on a beautiful woman, a noble woman, how they carry themselves? There's an erectness to their carriage. And she has a nobility and a godly pride to her. And he's proud of her. Verse 5 is great. Your breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that feed among the lilies. If you go down to a pond, you see two baby fawns. Those are two delicate things. You handle them softly and delicately. He's looking at the naked body of his wife here. And he doesn't look at his wife sexually like this is an object of my passion and now she has to do all of these fantasies that I've built up. He is not going to use his wife. How do you treat fawns with gentleness and with tenderness and kindness? This woman's going to say in a couple of chapters, his hands are hands of gold. He's so tender with his wife. So kind with her. In verse 6, he says, until the cool of the day when the shadows flee away, that's morning time, when the sun comes up, I will go to, and here are the mountains of Bether. Remember those? The mountains of separation. He's talking about the breast of his wife in verse 6. The mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. And he says, I want you in the sweetness of your love all night long. Now that is intimate. And in verse 7, he concludes it, you're altogether beautiful. There is no blemish in you. It goes without saying, I trust that none of you men have been so stupid as to have ever made a negative comment about the body of your wife. We should draw and quarter you. We should shoot you on sight if you ever did that. There is nothing, a woman becomes vulnerable to you and for you to make a disparaging comment. In chapter 1, how did this woman feel about herself? Don't stare at me because I'm swarthy, the sun has burnt me. He says, you're so perfect. So our first word is patient. Your next word, guys, is precious. He's just looking at his wife and he says, you're precious to me. You're wonderful to me. You want a great statement? It's a truism. It's cliche, but it's true. Women use sex to get romance. Men use romance to get sex. Men can't get enough sex. Women can't get enough romance. Men are thinking about the destination, women thinking about the road. Men are microwaves, women are crockpots. When is a man ready to have sex? Physically, it takes 7 seconds. That's all it takes. What does a man have to be doing? It don't matter. Anytime, any place, he's ready. That's the way he is. He's a microwave. He can heat up. He can see something, think of something. He can be doing something. A woman, it's not an intermission. It's the main event. And God has rigged it, guys. He has rigged sex. Because you can't be a good lover unless you have taken the garbage out. You got the car filled up when it was on E in February. You have complimented her, surprised her. You've been tender with her. You have loved her. What are those qualities called? Loving, tender, patient, respectable, admirable, praiseworthy. Those are called godly, holy qualities. Selfish, carnal people cannot make good lovers. I don't care if you look like Arnold and Rambo and all of them put together, you will not be a good lover. If you are not a guy who is a sensitive, caring guy, a gentle, compassionate, sympathetic person, tender towards your wife, that's what makes a woman want to give herself. You know, there's two books out right now on sex written by women that are secular books. And I'm not even going to tell you their titles because they are like a punch in the throat as far as what their titles are about sexual love. But you know what the essence of those books are about? They're written by women to men, and the essence of them is your ability to love your wife has to do with one thing, and that is tenderness. See, guys, God has rigged it. Your wife doesn't have your sex drive. She's not like you. Because if it was, all sex would be two animals mating in a room, and sex would be the constant expenditure of your selfishness. Your selfishness. Me. Always just feeding on each other. And that's not the way God has rigged it. It won't work unless I'm tender and kind and gentle and loving. So this guy treats her as precious. Man, best counsel I ever had, guys, before I got married, was a leader of a Christian organization took me aside and he said, "Let me tell you what I did wrong." He said, "When I got married," he said, I'd been a pagan for 20 years, got converted. This guy was a wrestler that was a fraternity guy from the Midwest. That's a bad combination to marry, all right? A frat guy who is a wrestler. And he said, he married this girl who was a South Texas Mennonite, who was taught that sex was something, it was one, two, make a baby. The reason you had sex was to propagate the race. It was an evil thing, but you had to endure it. That was your job. It's part of the curse of childbirth is sex, and that's the way she was taught. Here, this guy, they hadn't communicated. He comes roaring out of the bathroom, ready to excite and to elaborate on every fantasy he's ever had, everything he's ever read. And he's thinking, I have got now this sanctified prostitute in my bed, and she can't leave, and she's got a boy. And he went jumping in there, and man, he said, "I bruised her and I wounded her." And it took him years of counseling because he had no tenderness to her or to him. So that's the next principle here. Patience and preciousness. Kindness, gentleness. I like verse 8. Put down the word protection. Because if you are patient and if you are precious with your wife, it breeds protection. He says in verse 8, "Come away from Lebanon, my bride. Come away from Lebanon. Journey down the summit of Amana. Journey from the summit of Seir and Hermon. From the den of lions and the mountains of lepers." Now, what is this verse meaning? Come away from Mount Hermon. There was a prophet at the seminary that taught this once, and there was a woman in the study that when he said, "Come away from Hermon," she thought Hermon was her old boyfriend. Okay? Come on, get away from Hermon then. Hermon is a mountain in Israel, and it's the most intimidating thing you've ever seen. It's covered, sometimes shrouded by mist. Thunder showers on it, has snow up on it, and it's frightening, it's intimidating. And that's what her life was like, and that's what he calls her to. And he says, "You have had a life, guys, these women, these girls we dated have been hurt by men. Some of them have been hurt in their families. They have gone through lives of ridicule, some of them. Their self-images are not that great, and they get married, and they're kind of frightened because they're not sure what to expect from us. And our attitude has to be, I am a patient, precious treatment kind of a guy. And I'm going to protect you. And my bedroom is not a place that I'm going to hurt you. I'm going to take care of you. And the safest place you're ever going to have is under my wing. I cannot understand. I cannot relate to a man who will strike his wife. I can't relate to a man who will raise his voice and yell at his wife. If there's a guy here that uses ridicule and criticism on your wife, I can't imagine. I can't fathom how you do that. That this woman trusted you and got under your wing. You know, in a Jewish wedding, how you get married? You don't necessarily use a ring. When you pronounce a man and wife, the man takes his coat off. And he puts it over his wife in protection. And that's why the book of Malachi, God says, "I hate divorce and I hate him who covers his garment with violence." Who would put his garment over a wife than hurt her? It's protection. I asked my wife if I could tell this story. We got married out around Marshall, and we went to our honeymoon. And I was a high roller. I took her to Tyler. All right. So we're booking down the road, going to Tyler, Texas. Tyler's about 60 miles away, and we're going to Tyler. All right. And Teresa's so young and loving. We're just tight. We're tender, and she's sitting almost on the console. She got her arm around. We're in a 73 Torino, going down the road. Here come these signs coming by. Tyler, 60. Tyler, 50. Tyler, 40. And as those signs go by, I'm accelerating. See? On that road. And by the time we're in Tyler, Teresa has moved all the way over. And she's kind of sitting against the door looking at me. Because see, guys, she's taking a calculated gamble. When a woman marries you, she's not real sure as to whether she's getting Solomon or Norman Bates. Because sometimes they look about the same. So is your bedroom a place of protection that she knows I am received, I am treated tenderly, I am loved, I am stroked in a world that may scorn me and hurt me and badger me and beleaguer me? And once I lock that door and turn out those lights, there's somebody, there's a man who knows me like no man and is so tender. We've got patience, preciousness, protection. Now watch this. Verse 9, we've gone from looking at something to touching it. He says in verse 9, you've made my heart beat faster, my sister, my bride, with a single glance of your eyes, a single glance of your necklace. He's going right down her body. Verse 10, how beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine? He says, man, I'd rather be with you than all my buddies having a party. I would rather be with you. I can't imagine those guys who want to leave their wives, go play softball. Go bowling. He says, man, I'd rather be with you than any place. And in verse 11, look at this. Your lips, my bride, drip honey. Honey and milk are under your tongue. We've gone from looking to touching. What kind of kiss is that? Honey and milk are under your tongue. Don't stare at me. That's a French kiss. France didn't begin until the 800 ADs at the Treaty of Verdun. This is 1000 BC. A Hebrew kiss predates one of those by 1,800 years. I always tell singles, man, no matter how you kiss goodnight, don't be doing this. Because that's meant to hit some kilocycles. You want to know what the level of intensity is in touching? Hand to hand. All right, don't you singles write this down now. It goes like this. Hand to hand. Hand to shoulder. Hand to waist. Hand to face. Hand to head. You know that if touching your wife's head is more sensuous than touching her face. If a guy comes up and pats my wife's cheek, I kind of look at him. If he touches her head, I got to kill him. Because you don't do that. That's code of the hills. Don't be grabbing her head. Touch her head, and then you go mouth to face. You go mouth to mouth. You go hand to body. You go mouth to body, you go body to body. And that's the same. That is true in Denton. That is true in Dallas. That is true in the Congo. That is true in Alaska. It may not be true in Alaska, but I guess it is. It must be. You see the point? It's called the acceleration. And God gives it there for a reason. That's why if you're a single, you're going to get the law of diminishing returns if you don't watch it. First time I held my wife's hand, I felt 400 volts go right through me, just like that. But I held it again, and I didn't feel the intensity. I had to put my arm around. Now I got it, see. And then pretty soon, the voltage kept going down. You get the law of diminishing returns, and it's meant to be diminishing. It's meant to continue all the way until sex. God made us like that. Because now, sex is not two slugs on a leaf. It is a loving, tender thing. And that's what sex is if you don't have intimacy, isn't it? You two dang slugs on a leaf. That's a dang shame. Did I say that to first service? Where was I? Verse 12. You ready? A garden locked is my sister, my bride, a rock garden locked, a spring sealed up. All of a sudden, he's all intense, he's all pumped, he's all hopped, he's all moving. In 12, she is sealed up. Solomon is a king. There is nothing in the nation that is sealed from him except this. It's the sexuality of his wife. She is sealed. She has a divine stamp. She is hands off. The sexuality of a man biblically is spoken of as a spring. Proverbs says for a man not to cast his springs into the gutter. And so be delighted with a harlot. A woman's sexuality biblically is called a well. For obvious anatomical reasons, she is a well. This woman is called a spring-fed well in a garden. Because in that arid culture, a garden is a little bit of heaven. It's like the Garden of Eden. It's like the eternal state in Revelation 22 is a garden. It's a place of refreshment, of excitement. And he sees the sexuality of his wife as a garden, as a spring-fed well. Fellas, ladies, sex is meant to be the greatest vacation that there is, that I can come into my house and I can lock that door and I can turn out those lights. And man, I don't care how tough my day has been, I have a little bit of heaven right there. A joyous place of getaway, that there's somebody that loves me, somebody that is tender with me, somebody that's kind with me, somebody that accepts me. That's sex. Somebody I can be ultimately vulnerable. The highest degree of vulnerability, and she still loves me. It's an oasis. But Solomon says, up until this time, hands off. This spring does not flow until the wedding day. Singles, sex is meant for virgins. I have had people come to me and say, Tom, aren't you supposed to get a little experience? The book of the Song of Solomon is the norm on sex, the same as Romans is the norm on salvation, Galatians the norm on freedom, Ephesians is the norm on the church. This is the norm on sex. Anything outside of this book is what? Abnormal. Sex before marriage creates abnormal tendencies, abnormal appetites, abnormal habits. The worst thing you can do for your future sexual relationship is get into sex. Now, some of you couples, I know I'm not talking to 500 virgins. Some of you messed up, and it's cost you because you never learned to burn deep. You never learned to reconcile. Sex became a power, not a follow-through. The embers aren't there. The intimacy's not there. Respect isn't there. Now sexuality's died off and you're trying to manipulate each other. God can change that, but you're going to have to go back and you guys are going to have to start treating your wife in a precious way. It's amazing how a woman can flower under a tender husband. A husband she respects. So that's your next P. Purity. And now we go to the next P. Verse 13. Your shoots, he talks about this woman, are an orchard of pomegranate, choice fruits, henna, nard, saffron, calamus, cinnamon, all the trees of frankincense, myrrh, aloes, with the finest spices. Verse 15. You are a garden spring, a well of fresh water, streams flowing from Lebanon. This well is flowing. And in verse 16, she says, now twice in the book, what has she said while they're dating? Don't arouse or awaken love until it pleases. Don't arouse or awaken love until it pleases. Verse 16, what's the first word? Awake, son. Does God know how to make us? Now it is time for the honeymoon, and she says, awake, be aroused. And he says, verse 16, she calls him north wind. That is a strong, powerful gust. Wind of the south, that is a very gentle breeze. She wants him strong, and she wants him gentle. She says, make my garden breathe. Let it carry out its aroma. Now, you're sitting there thinking, whoa, how sensuous is that text? Answer, it's as sensuous as your mind can imagine it. Will your righteousness ever exceed the expectation and the command of God in Romans? Never. Will your holiness ever exceed the command of God in Ephesians to cast out the old leaven that you can be a new lump? Never. Will your unity ever exceed the book of Ephesians? Never. Will your trusting in God ever exceed the sufficiency of Christ in Romans and Colossians? Never. Now, do you really think that your sensuality as a couple is ever going to exceed the divine expectation in Song of Solomon? You guys, me, we think we're such lovers. We guys think we're so sensual. You are a polar bear. You are frigid as a clam, every guy in here. You take your love and sensuality, we think we wrote the book on it. We don't even come close to what God calls sensuality. The next P, put down the word pleasure. It is intended for pleasure. Woody Allen said, sex is the most fun you can have without laughing. That's the greatest statement I've ever heard on sex. Dr. Ed Wheat wrote a book on sex. He called it Intended for Pleasure, and it is. I asked my wife, you know, I said, give me some insight. I said, when men get older, They lose creativity and spontaneity, and they are crushed under responsibility and duty. Because men do. They have so many duties and responsibilities. They quit being tender, quit being romantic, quit being exciting. I said, what do women become? It took her that long. She said, women become crotchety and crabby. That's why the Old Testament tells a woman not to be on two occasions a dripping faucet. A wise woman builds her house, a foolish one tears it down with her own hand. When women get old, they can just get so inflexible. My wife was telling me that. She's the ultimate authority. She's going to know that stuff. And women do. And instead of being responsive, and I want to give a word to the ladies. What if you ask a million men what makes a great lover, you'll get the same answer a million times. Responsiveness. Being a beautiful woman or a shapely woman does not make you a good lover, because when you take a shower, take off the makeup, and turn off the lights, it don't matter anymore. That's a neat thing about sexuality. All women are at the same starting line. Do you know that? Physical looks and beauty are at the bottom of the sensuality rung. The very bottom. Because when you turn out the lights, all the women are at the same starting block. And if a woman is not tender, giving, if she does not use, you can't have sight anymore. Now you've got touch, taste, smell. The way she kisses, the way she touches, and what she says. Now that's great, because that doesn't take how you look. That takes wisdom and creativity and holiness on a woman's part to be a great lover. She's got to think. You just can't always take maybe the same nightgown to bed that you've been wearing since 1946. See? Ladies, I've heard ladies talk about this. I was teaching this one time out in West Texas, and there was a group of ladies just cracked up, and they got to telling nightgown stories. I think that there is a place when a woman has been married for 3 months that sends her a nightgown. It's a place, it's in Moose Jaw, Alaska, all right? And this nightgown is made out of seal, all right? And you couldn't see through it if she stood next to a solar flare. Can feel nothing under it. But it's comfortable, you know. And they wear it, then they give it to their daughters. They give it to theirs. Guys, you ain't got to go to bed smelling like two-cycle oil, you know. You can put something on. Ain't it the truth? It really is. So, responsiveness. Let me give a word to you guys. That's why I love third service, because you don't have to turn things out. You can just keep going, because nobody's coming in there. We're already five over here. Something to you guys. You have to be a gentle shepherd in sex. Your parameters of sex and creativity and what goes in bed is wider than your wife's. How far? Guys always ask me that. What's legal in the bedroom? And I tell them, I don't know. It depends on your wife. You demean your wife or shame your wife or do something she's not ready for, you'll hurt her so deeply, make her feel so inadequate. When you watch an orchestra begin, what's the first thing that happens? Concert master strings that violin and everybody listens and adjusts to him. When you guys go to bed with your wife, you've got to listen. Because I'll tell you something about women. Guys are always looking for the combination. You know what I'm saying? The hardest I've ever laughed was this guy. I've been married about 6 months. He said, man, I can't find the combination on this man. Because see, this is the way stupid men are. Men are always full bore in a bedroom. They're always full bore. They're ready to roll. A woman, she comes to bed, it's a different kind of a deal. It's this week to this week to this week. And man, this guy, see, he's having sex with his wife and he's got a notepad here. Wait a minute, dear. And he's taking his notes down. Number one, kiss. Time to touch here. Three, bingo. All right. The next week he tries it and she said, what are you, sick? You know, get away. And he don't know what to do. So guys, God has rigged it so you can't just go and pull the trigger at night and just think, hey, this has got to work. You've got to go and be sensitive and listen to the pulse of your wife. And that's neat, because God's rigged it. You've got to be a gentle shepherd that shepherds his flock among the lilies. If you're a selfish oaf, you're not going to be a good lover. You've got to be gentle. God will form you. He'll take you from Jethro Bodine to Errol Flynn in about 10 years if you're going to be a good lover. Okay? Now let me give you a final word to the couples here. You ready? Giving a word to the wives, responsiveness. Men, gentleness. Couples, talk. Why don't we talk about sexual relationships within? I know couples that have never talked about it. When you go on your honeymoon, you singles, you're going to spend most of your honeymoon laughing at each other. You don't go on a honeymoon to have an ecstatic experience. You've got to talk. You've got to turn the lights on. You're going to have to guide this guy's hand and guide her hand. They don't know what to do. And yet couples get into marriage and they never talk. They've never sat down and the guy spoke with tenderness and the woman listened with open ears and said to her, "This is pleasant. This is pleasant. This at times isn't." The woman has never said, "When you do this, when you do this, when you do this." You've got to talk. To really enjoy intimacy, you've got to communicate and do it with tenderness. That's why one of the greatest things that happens in marriage is the developing of signals. You know what I'm saying? How do you know when your mate is desirous of you? Now, the guy doesn't come home and go, 6:10:30, be there. You got signals. Would anyone like to share just what your signal? You all got signals, don't you? I knew a guy in the Navigators. They're not quite as tender. He would call home and he'd say to his wife, "I'll be home by 10 o'clock. Yeah, I'll plug in the iron." Plug in the iron. That was the way he did. I know another guy. He told me, he said, "Whenever my wife hears the shaving cream, it's 10 o'clock. She's reading in the bed. She hears over here." Why do you shave at 10 o'clock? Well, see. Now, the guy never announces it. Oh, dear. Here we go now. But she's supposed to hear it because it's tender. When a wife... I was talking this out in West Texas, and this woman right down the second row just cracked up right here. Because she said that she had one of those seal robes, you know. And whenever she would take off her seal robe and wear something a little nicer, that was a key. Sometimes it's the smell of a certain perfume. Sometimes it's a certain kind of touch. We've all got signals. And you gotta read those signals. Sometimes, like quarterback, you gotta check off. You know, call an audible. Bail out. Run. Call time. Do something. 5:1. Here's your last two P's. 5:1. "I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride, gathered my myrrh, my balsam, my honeycomb, my honey, my wine, and my milk." It's in the past tense. Sex is over. They are lying there. And you notice what he says 9 times. "She is mine, 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 mine." That's what sex is. "The two shall become one flesh." When do you become one flesh? When you get the same mailbox? Same post office box? Ring on your finger? Preacher to say, "I now pronounce you man and wife"? No. It's when that couple has sex. That's where you have a financial, domestic, social, emotional, spiritual, physical commitment. It starts way down deep in your heart and it works out until your wedding day. And now you're one. And that is why singles, you do not have sex with people who are not your wives. One last P. God speaks in 5:1. Isn't this great? The only verse God speaks in the whole book after he watches sex and a voice speaks out of the dark and says, "Eat, friends, drink, and imbibe deeply, O lovers." God says, go for it. Friends and lovers, go for it. It's a meal. It's companionship. Eat and drink. And how should you eat and drink in sex? Just to get it over with? What's the word? Deeply. You know, I got married 17 years ago, and I'll be honest with you, my wife and I have never had sexual problems other than times of just miscommunication that we all have. But do you know what? Our physical relationship is so much better now. My wife has had 2 children. She doesn't look near like the homecoming runner-up she did in 1968. But you know what? It's so much better now. I was in a whole lot better shape then than I am now. But you know what? It's so much better because we have learned each other. We appreciate each other. And the embers we feel for each other are so much deeper now. And it's so much sweeter. Friends and lovers, Well, how do you close this service?
Be ye not merely hearers of the word.
Now, if you didn't take your wife out to eat last week like I told you, you forget this week. Ladies, you cut him off. All right. I'm kidding.
Let me ask you something. How personal do you think God is? How deep do you think God is? How much do you think God loves you? If He can communicate this deeply to things that are done behind locked doors with the darkness, with the lights out, how deeply do you think God wants to make you happy and that He loves you? We're going to pray. Mark Bova, give me something soft and smooth. Give me a little Andy Williams. I don't think we got anything in the hymnal. You got anything soft for a prayer on honeymoons and stuff? We'll try. Start me out there. What do you got? Awesome. Perry Como. That's it. Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you so much that you are so deeply concerned about the sweetest things of our lives. You were concerned about my salvation, so you sent your Son. You were concerned about my righteousness, so you provided a Holy One of God. You were concerned with my resurrection, so you raised Him. You're concerned with my enlightenment, so you gave me my Bible. You're concerned with the great and mighty things. But Lord, you are just as concerned with what takes place in the most intimate occasion of my life. Thank you for the sweetness of marital intimacy, the hydraulic system of emotion. And I pray for all of us that before we become lovers, we might be friends. And we just ask this and remember it for Jesus' sake. Amen. We're dismissed.